Meeting of Ag and Natural Resources Committee, April 3rd. Appreciate all the people being here. It's good to see some people I haven't seen for a while, so that's nice too. We have a number of public hearings, and we're going to start with 3337. We're probably going to move to the bill at the bottom, which is the one that has a work session, because some of our members have to come and go, but we'll look at that after 3337. So right now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3337. We'll have a short explanation and then Representative Beyer. And if you want to bring whoever you want to bring with you.
Your entourage.
This bill does establish a schedule for review of buildable land supply for our local governments within a metropolitan planning organization. Requires cities with a population of 50,000 or more within Lane County to demonstrate separately from another city with a population of 50,000 or more that the urban growth boundary contains sufficient buildable lands. There are some dash one amendments that we just received, so we'll have to defer to the I think Representative Beyer and her people to perhaps explain what these amendments do. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Representative Terry Beyer, House District 12, which is Springfield. And thank you for having us here today and hearing our bill. House Bill, of course, House Bill 3337 was just like most of the other bills that came out of LC and wasn't quite what we wanted, although it's real close. I will say that. And there are a few changes, but they don't dramatically... I will let other people explain what the differences are, probably, rather than me. But this bill is about providing choices for the community that I represent. It's about ensuring that both my city and the city next door have the option of meeting their own goals for land uses. And it's about making sure that young people have a fair shot at owning a home. In the Eugene-Springfield area, the two cities have for over 50 years planned jointly for growth of the two communities. Our area is one of the few that has a combined metropolitan land use plan and was one of the first to have its land use plan acknowledged by LCDC. And that was in the early 80s. But times have changed. The two cities now have different aspirations as to how the communities want to grow. As a former six-year city councilor, I'm very supportive of local control. And I think that communities should have the right to plan together. I also think that cities should have the right to go separate ways. And that's what local control is all about. And basically, that's what this bill is about. I introduced this bill at the request of the City of Springfield in cooperation with the local home builders. And I introduced it because I was concerned about our communities were not adequately planning for new housing, and as a result, young people were being deprived of an opportunity to buy an affordable home. And as I talked with our local officials, it became clear that Springfield wished to update their land use plan for their half of the urban growth boundary. On the other hand, Eugene did not. This is what the bill is intended to do, is not to break apart the local metropolitan land use plan. Rather, it is intended to allow Springfield to move ahead and update their portion of the plan. If that results in a demonstrated need to expand their site of the urban growth boundary, then the city could do so with the approval of LCDC. I think this is in keeping with the tradition of Oregon's land use planning and is intended to continue to meet all state planning goals. And I hope you will act favorably on this bill, and I will allow our mayor and local land use professionals to address the technical aspects of the bill. And just for your information, I'll let them introduce themselves, but my mayor, Sid Lycan, and our planning department is Bill Grell. And I'll take a seat somewhere else.
Well, thank you, Chair Roebling and members of the committee. And just first of all, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak. For the record, my name is Sid Lycan. I serve as the mayor of the city of Springfield. Springfield welcomes all efforts made by the legislature that make governance at the local level more responsive to the needs of our citizens and our communities. I believe local elected officials are in the best position to determine the most appropriate course of action for their cities. However, I recognize the role the state must take in the interest of the common good. Oregonians by nature have a pioneering spirit. They make deliberate choices to live and work in cities and counties because of the unique social, economic, and environmental attributes found in these cities and counties. It is with this concept of the continuing importance of individuality within our intergovernmental relationships that we appear here to testify in support of HB 3337. Rather than addressing the specific text of the bill, because our staff is here to make those points, I'd like to convey to the subcommittee that the Springfield City Council wants very much to accommodate its future citizens in a way that preserves choices, provides efficient services, and promotes the economic and social well-being of generations yet to come. Planning for our future cannot happen in a vacuum, so we will continue to rely on and support the regional partnerships that make living in the Southern Willamette Valley such a pleasure. Yet at the same time, we cannot continue to modify our responsibility and effectiveness to this challenge by defaulting to a vague metro area inventory that may indeed absorb future growth, but denies the inevitability that people may choose to live in one city rather than the other. Contrary to what many may believe, Springfield embraces partnerships. Through the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission, we have a single wastewater management district overseen by Springfield, Eugene, and Lane County. We have a single regional transportation plan overseen by Springfield, Eugene, Lane County, Coburg, and the Lane Transit District. A single public facilities and services plan adopted by Springfield, Eugene, and Lane County, and the elected boards of our local utility providers. We share a single air protection agency, an MPO comprised of 12 cities, Lane County, and others. We also have a single comprehensive land use plan jointly adopted by Springfield, Eugene, and Lane County elected officials. I fully understand and believe in the strength of partnerships. In fact, I believe this bill preserves and strengthens our relationships with Eugene and Lane County by acknowledging that the individual roles and responsibilities of the cities in the growth and development of the metropolitan area are as important as any of the joint functions we routinely undertake. We do not wish to inconvenience our partners, nor do we wish to cause them to assume additional responsibilities as a result of legislation that will address Springfield's concerns. But we must level the playing field. We believe that this legislation provides benefits to all involved by providing accurate, timely information, in turn allowing policymakers to make good decisions. In closing, this legislation addresses a circumstance unique to our comprehensive plan, which is the distinction between municipal and regional inventories. While our comprehensive plan talks of accommodating a metropolitan UGB population within a single UGB, it does not address the reality of this occurring by virtue of individuals selecting between one of two cities within the same UGB. We cannot know how to accurately and responsibly plan for our city without assuming that we have an inventory that is designed and intended for Springfield's population growth and not the metropolitan population. Our comprehensive plan states that the division of responsibility for metropolitan planning between the two cities is the Interstate 5 highway. It's about time the buildable lands inventories were based on this same distinction. This bill will provide another tool in our toolbox, allowing continued local governance that is efficient and effective and provides a common sense approach. We also have a letter for the record from our general manager of Springfield Utility Board, Bob Linehan. We also would like to submit on their behalf. But again, thank you very much for allowing us to testify. And again, this is Bill Greil, our Development Services Director of the City of Springfield, and I believe he has some comments too. Thank you.
It is.
Okay, now.
It took Representative Clem a little while to make the connection. Those of us who, Bill was the city manager in Coos Bay for many years before he moved, so we've known him. And,
this is a little beer or something. <aren't they?
laughs> With apologies to that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Bill Greil, the Development Services Director for the City of Springfield. And as you just heard from Mayor Lyken, Eugene and Springfield have a single comprehensive plan that was jointly adopted and that has a single urban growth boundary that is based on metropolitan analyses of needs and land use inventories, not on those for each individual city, but for the combination of the two. One of the problems with a multi-jurisdictional inventory is that neither city can say there's either a shortfall or a surplus of land in their respective cities, since the inventory is based on a metropolitan analysis as opposed to individual population projections for each city. House Bill 3337, as amendments proposed, removes the non-specific relationship of that inventory and population and requires each city to demonstrate that the projected growth for that city can be accommodated by the buildable lands within that individual city. This is a requirement of the law for all cities in Oregon other than Portland Metro. Eugene Springfield, by their own choice, created this hybrid, the Eugene Springfield Metro Plan, 25 years ago as a model. And it now takes, as we see it, an act of the legislature to set right, given anxieties that regional consensus about growth management no longer exists. The existing system is beginning to show some serious shortcomings. For at least 2 years, on the Springfield side, we've been listening to concerns and complaints from builders, realtors, citizens, home builders, etc., about the shortfall of land for growth on the Springfield side. And my building official, for example, says that if he goes to the counter and he says, what's the one thing I can do to help you accommodate housing in Springfield? And the answer is, find me something to build on that is not as steep as the back of my head. And therein lies the crux of the problem. The situation has become so dire that you see these outlying satellite communities, Crestwell, Vinita, Junction City, Cottage Grove, even Lowell, experiencing build-out of their inventories at a more rapid rate than what they had anticipated. And, of course, the jobs and the services are principally in Eugene Springfield, not in these outlying communities which require transportation impacts and commutes and so forth. These smaller cities, several have asked the Lane Council of Governments to review their own population projections since they have experienced this more rapid growth than they'd originally envisioned, and therein lies a compounding of the problem. 12 years ago, Eugene and Springfield reached, and with the cooperation of Lane County, reached an accord, an amendment to the Metro Plan that would allow plan amendments entirely within the city limits of either city to be made without the concurring support of the other city, basically relegating that other partner city to pretty much interested party status in the event that there would be serious land use concerns that could lead to an appeal. And in doing so, you'll see in the Metro Plan today language that talks about, quote, the division of responsibility for metropolitan planning between the two cities as being Interstate 5. In the written testimony that I'm submitting for you to review, you'll see a map that depicts that. Eugene and Springfield can make virtually any magnitude of change either desires, and their Metro Plan partners are accorded this basically party status. They can't stop it. So in other words, by making incremental changes to the plan within a city on either side of I-5, they can adversely affect the inventory, but because it takes the concurrence of all three jurisdictions, the elected officials of Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County, to amend the plan to do an urban growth boundary expansion, neither of the cities can basically fix the problem that they're allowed by the plan to create. And therein lies the crux of what brings us here today. Mayor Lycan talked about Springfield's support for partnerships. It's one of the things that I think is really legendary in our community. And this is not about breaking up the Metro Plan or about doing away with regional planning. To the contrary, we see this as an opportunity to strengthen the partnership and perhaps to even save the Metro Plan should certain events lead forth to where, frankly, if Springfield was to document what we feel is the obvious, that there is, in fact, a shortfall, if Springfield is not allowed to expand the urban growth boundary to meet that shortfall, because there is either a real or perceived surplus on the Eugene side of the Metro plan, then basically that would relegate Springfield to a moratorium for however long it would be until that supply got used up and an expansion was allowed. So that's why we're here today, and I just thank you very much for considering what our concerns are.
I'll ask one question. The dash ones, the amendments, have
yes.
you seen them? What do they do exactly?
Basically, it's the dash one amendments, in particular with section three, that say that each city has to have its own projected needs identified on its side of I-5 based on language that's in the Metro plan. And then each city has to meet those needs, either through increased density or through expanded urban growth boundary changes or perhaps even redesignating certain designations of land use plan designations, each one on its own side.
Okay. Questions? Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit about what policies you currently have in place to promote density within your existing UGB?
Well, the existing plan designations provide a range of housing types as required by Goal 10,
mm-hmm.
And that includes manufactured homes, mobile homes, apartments, and single-family attached and detached dwellings. When we go to look at meeting any shortfall, we're required under the state rules to look at various ways to meet that shortfall, including increasing density, redesignations, or expanding the urban growth boundary.
Okay, follow-up?
Yes.
So are you, I mean, this is somewhat of a subjective question, but, you know, I live in the city of Portland. We don't have a lot of new land to bring into the UGB, so there's really been a huge emphasis on, obviously, building up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been in Portland lately, it's happening at a pretty fast rate. But, you know, there's been a lot of incentives put in place to incentivize for builders to do that. So I was just curious if the city council has looked at anything like that.
We will be required to look at alternatives like that if and when the established need is brought forward to the council. Springfield right now is very near the completion of an inventory of land supply for residential lots and the demand piece that goes with it, looking at the regional housing market as well as the demand for housing specifically in the city limits. When the question then turns to assuming that there is a documented shortfall, how do you meet it? Then we will look at those three things that I said: increasing density, redesignations, expanding the urban growth boundary.
Continue.
Any other questions? Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, in the Portland metro area, of course, we have a regional government that oversees the urban growth boundary expansions. And I think one of the essential aspects of that is that because there are three different counties involved, county government can't perform that function. It would seem to a sort of more distant observer as though the county government, since all of the metropolitan area of Eugene Springfield is inside one county, would logically perform that function, that is, coordinating what's pursued by one end of the urban growth boundary with what's going on at the other end. Why couldn't that be handled effectively on a coordinated basis at the county?
It could and is legally required to be so. Even with the metro plan, the county has those very coordination responsibilities that you described, Representative McPherson, under ORS 197. I believe it's 197-175. So even without the metro plan, there is that required coordination.
So if I could follow. Yeah. So then my question is, why should we be... in effect, turning each municipality, you know, giving them the latitude to make their own case for expanding their part of the urban growth boundary based on their own separately identified needs, rather than saying it's one metropolitan area and there needs to be coordination among those needs. And if there's too great a risk, as I can imagine there might be, between in the competition between the two municipalities, why wouldn't we then expect the county to oversee that process and determine if there's too much land being added at the west end, that it's preventing the amount of buildable land that's necessary at the east end, that the county would then, in effect, arbitrate that issue?
I'm going to answer from the political standpoint, because I think you need to hear part of this. First of all, it's a very good question, a question maybe we've been asking ourselves. We have actually provided an invitation to looking at how do we accommodate and how do we work within our scope, our boundaries, and what's the market calling for? I mean, first of all, the market's calling for a wide array of housing needs in our community. We're clearly, I don't know what's going on in the Portland metro area, but we're clearly driving young families out of the marketplace, and that's why they're moving to the outlying areas of Bonita, Junction City, and then working in Eugene Springfield. So in a sense, what they're doing is they're driving 40 miles round trip to in a sense work in the metro area. What we're trying to do here is we see the need. We're talking with folks in our community, and because we have the one metro plan that guides us and the one contiguous urban growth boundary, even with Springfield wanting to look at accommodating the different or the wide variety of needs by citizens, in a sense, we cannot move forward on this without, for lack of a better word, getting permission. And we've invited Eugene to participate in a land study with us, and they've declined. Well, we feel like that the next step is to either look at this legislation, or we could clearly, from a legal standpoint, say we're going to separate, put together our own comp plan, and like you say, work with Lane County to, I guess, provide the land needs within the jurisdiction of Springfield. And so from a political standpoint, we have made that offer. And at this point in time, Eugene has declined, and which is their decision, which is fine. But we feel compelled to move forward, and because of what's going on. I mean, you know, for instance, Springfield last year grew by well over 2%, so about 2.2%, which doesn't sound like much, but I got to tell you, that was the highest increase in population growth Springfield has seen in quite some time. And so, we're feeling the effects that people want to move in. We've had a little explosive amount of economic growth. We've seen $850 million in new permittable construction economic growth going on in Springfield just in this decade alone. So folks are wanting to move in, but yet where are they going to move to? If they want to continue moving in the outlying areas, in a sense, where you're going to be creating is more urban sprawl, because those communities will be moving back and touching Eugene Springfield, or in particular touching Springfield on the west end. And so what it is, more than anything else, is just trying to allow ourselves choices here, and making sure that we will provide choices for density, but at the same time, if folks want to build a different type of home, we're not looking at major ranch-style homes on five-acre plots within the city by any stretch of the imagination, because we want to have that continued coordinated effort. But that's where we are, and that's why we're here with this legislation today and why we're supporting it.
Hey, Bill, do you have a technical...
Well, I guess what I would say is that except for Portland Metro, it is exactly as you described for every other city and county that I'm aware of in Oregon. And if these two cities were not contiguous and not so-called yoked together under this voluntary arrangement called the Metro Plan, they would basically put forward a proposed urban growth boundary expansion based on a justification package. The county would review it and either agree or disagree, and then if it's over 50 acres, it would go to the Land Conservation and Development Commission under the rules for expanding an urban growth boundary. With the Metro Plan, in effect, even Lane County can be trumped by either Eugene or Springfield because it requires the concurrence of all three elected bodies in order to amend the Metro Plan. And that's what's different about Eugene-Springfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Well, we'll start with Representative Glenn.
Yes. Actually, that last point was sort of my question. I don't know if you're familiar with Salem-Keizer in that regard, but I had there's a piece of, I think it's 100 acres, that's somehow inside the city but outside the UGB, and there's a bill that, you know, would remedy that. And one of the things that Salem said to me was, well, Keizer will never approve any of our UGB expansions, and we'll never approve any of theirs, you know, something like that, so we're never going to get anywhere. Same exact deal, except what I don't know is about Marion County's role, and I wondered if you just by some chance know about the Salem-Keizer situation.
Well, I know a little bit about Representative Klein, not a great deal, but I can tell you that there's language in the Keizer urban growth policies. This is a document I'll submit for the record. Salem-Keizer Urban Area Regional Procedures and Policies Definitions, and it talks, for example, Salem-Keizer Urban Area, and then Salem Urban Area, and I'll just define it for one, the area within the Salem city limits and the area within the Salem-Keizer Urban Growth Boundary, which is incorporated and is located to the south, east, and west of the common city limits, you know, known as blah, blah, blah. And so each of those jurisdictions has their own discrete planning area. And without looking further, I have to believe that each one's needs were met, just as we're requesting here. If not, I guess I would question how that came about.
Yeah, I don't think they are, because when they're coming to the state legislature, much like you, to solve a problem between themselves, and they claim that, you know, Keizer keeps vetoing, and I don't know if it's true, but that's the, you know, the lobbying I got was Keizer won't let them do what they want to do out in this other part of town because they're stuck together. So I'll do my own homework on that. I'm just curious what you knew. Thank you.
Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just trying to simplify this thing, and tell me, Mayor, if I'm wrong when I outline this parable here. This just appears that all three of you, all three, Lynn County, Eugene, and Springfield, all have to agree to go to the dance together or get a divorce. And at this point, we're just trying to get some counseling so that all three agree that we should have this inventory and we should do this, or you're going to get a divorce. That's kind of what I'm hearing. Am I close?
Yeah, actually, you are more than close. And,
all right, fine. So I got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Dillon.
Well, I just had it's sort of a follow-up question to Representative Clem, is that if you're the only jurisdiction, I mean, it's not clear for me from reading the language, including the amended language, if you're the only jurisdictions that are affected by this bill, are there other jurisdictions that fall under this category that will be affected? And then maybe that's a question asked DLCD.
There are other jurisdictions that would be affected. Springfield's principal interest is Section 3, mm-hmm. because we believe very strongly that we need good information to make planning decisions and recommendations to our Planning Commission and Council. And for that reason, we've nearly completed a housing study, and there is a proposal in our budget for a that'll be coming forward to the Budget Committee here in a couple of weeks for a $160,000 study dealing with the commercial and industrial buildable lands, the other part of the equation here.
I think it's going to be important that we hear, Mr. Chair, from the other cities that are affected by this too, obviously, because we don't want any unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, but that's just Section 3.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So I am going to close.
Even the amended.
I'm going to close this hearing for just a short period of time. We have a work session we want to get in, and then we'll bring back to this one, and we'll start right back again. But we had a work group that came back with a bill, and we need to get it moved. So we're going to open hearing on, public hearing on 2293, and we'll have a short explanation of what we're going. And
thank you, Chair. The original bill, HB 2293, that was carried over from last meeting, amends the Forest Resource Program Trust Statutes and establishes a voluntary cost share program on authorizing state forester market register transfer and sell credits for environmental services attributed to land trust. We do have in your packet the dash one amendments. as well as a Hannah Gross version of 2293 with the dash one amendments in there, and I will defer to Mike Caparata from ODF, who I believe is here, who will walk you through those. Additionally, in the packet is a minimal impact statement from LFO indicating the dash one amendments do basically remove most of the expenditure, and then a letter from the speaker saying if the dash ones are amended, we can resend the referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. So we'll have Mike. Should we have the other Mike come up as well? Yeah. Might as well have Mike from Oregon Small Woodlands as well.
Thank you, Chair Revlin, members of the committee. My name is Mike Caparata from the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2293 and the amendments. On January 30th, you had a discussion about House Bill 2293 and the Forest Resource Trust. I won't repeat any of that information. I'll just talk today about the amendments to that bill. As a result of that January 30th meeting, you recommended the department form a work group and work through some issues in the Forest Resource Trust bill, and we did that. We had a work group that worked actively on that. The biggest thing to work through in that was environmental services, the ecosystem services portion of that. And the entire work group was very unanimous. This is a really important topic for this committee and for the legislature, for the Department of Forestry, and for the state of Oregon. They were also unanimous that this bill is probably not the place to have that discussion. We ended up dropping that environmental services, ecosystem services part of the bill out and saved that discussion for a different place. And there are a variety of very good reasons for that. We had a really good discussion about it. And you'll probably hear more about this at a later time. There's some other small things we did with the bill, some reorganizations. So you'll see there's a lot of amendments, but a lot of that is just reorganization for clarity in the legislation. Some oversight. There was some discussion about oversight. We added a report to the 2011 Legislative Assembly. There were some other minor clarifications about who qualifies and adding language about the Department of Fish and Wildlife's conservation strategy as far as prioritization. And with that, the work group is all unanimous. They support this bill as it is. It makes some important changes to resource trust that make it more efficient and more effective at delivering services for Oregon's landowners and the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions, or should we have? Well, go ahead.
Chair Robin, thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Gadern. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And on behalf of our group and other members of the work group, we would like to thank the committee and the chair for giving us the time to work on this. It's a very important issue for us, not only here in Oregon, but also at national level. I was back in D.C. just this week, and there's an amazing coalition coming together around ecosystem services and loss of private working forest land. So it's very much a topic here in Oregon and elsewhere. We support the amendments and the bill. We think it's the best way to go right now. We would like to see support of best actors for folks that are out there doing it through voluntary market opportunities. And as Mike said, we think that, that those discussions will occur beyond the discussions we've had on this particular bill. But once again, thank you all for your allowing us the time to work on these on this bill.
Questions?
So, I just want to be clear as far as the fiscal impact. This is all going to be absorbed within the existing, since we have the minimal expenditure impact. This is going to, and since we're in the process of hearing your budget, this is all going to be absorbed within the Department of Forestry's budget.
Yeah, Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder. Yes, thank you. We believe this will make it more efficient and more effective, and we should be able to do a better job of administering it as it is, and so it should save us time in administration through these changes.
Okay, follow up? Yep. Just for the committee's sake, how many FTE do you currently have administering this program?
Well, it's actually administered by all of our stewardship foresters, about 47 across the state, so each one of them might have a project in their area of the Forest Resource Trust. It's a very small part of many people's time. And with these changes, it might remain a very small part of many people's time.
So just clarification, you don't have at this time then a plan to have that consolidated into one FTE, or so everybody is trained on what the Forest Resource Trust program is?
Yeah, Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder. Because of the nature of these projects where they're spread out across the state, it's always a difficult thing to have everybody trained up to be able to provide this. We have some folks in Salem who are knowledgeable about several programs. This is one of their programs to oversee, and they help stewardship foresters through this whenever it comes up. So it's a small part of those folks in Salem's time as well.
Thank you.
Representative Boklitz.
Yes, David Williams, Chair, since we raised the issue, we have a shortage of steward foresters, and anything that will help give them more contact with the local small woodlands owners and the citizens of the state of Oregon is a positive thing. And if we even added 10 or 15 more stewarded foresters, we would not get to where we need to be.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, and thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2293.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendments to what was it, House Bill 2293.
Representative Clem moves that we adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2293. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we move to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation and rescind the referral to Ways and Means, House Bill 2293.
So Representative Clem has moved that with a due pass recommendation, House Bill 2293 with the -1 amendments, and that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take the roll.
Representative Boklitz?
Aye.
Representative
Clem?
Aye.
Representative
Jinkson?
Aye.
Representative
McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Robles?
Aye. Bill passes. Thank you very much for all of that. And who would like to carry this? Mr. Boklitz?
Delighted, Mr. Chair.
So we'll have Representative Boklitz carry this bill. You can get your point in about more foresters.
Yeah.
Sure, I will, Mr. Chair.
So we will close the hearing on the work session on 2293, and we'll open a hearing, public hearing on 3337. Thank you for allowing us to take care of some house work here. So
we're
next.
2 for 2 on work groups so far.
That's right. Yeah. That's true. Our work group.
We started the annexation one today. That'll be a no-brainer, right?
So, John Chandler, and did you have a group of people with you, John? Okay.
And Rocky Wheeler.
Yeah, that's an easy one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Easy work group.
No, we're talking about we're here for the next
Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on House Bill 3337. You've already heard from the City of Springfield. I want to add a little bit to their testimony and also give you a bit of the background noise and also take a stab at answering Representative Dingfelder's question. Before I forget, however, I do want to indicate two things for the record. The first is the -1 amendments are intended, amongst other things, to take Metro out of the bill. I believe they do. Metro, on a quick read, believes they do. If they do not, we will have -2 amendments that take Metro out of the bill. Secondly, the League of Oregon Cities has expressed some concern on behalf of the MPOs that are covered by the bill as to timing and language, and we're more than happy to work with them. I'm not sure what all those concerns are, but I've talked with Ms. Ludwig, and I think we'll be able to address them. The bill in front of you does two things, really. First thing it does is what you heard about from the City of Springfield. It addresses a peculiar situation in Lane County. The second thing it does is affects, I think, 5 jurisdictions in Oregon, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, MPOs, which is a federal designation for transportation funding, but it's basically the big cities. It's Corvallis, Medford area, Bend, Eugene Springfield, Salem-Keizer. Metro would also is an MPO. It will not be covered. That part of the bill, and this is perhaps getting to what Representative Dingfelder was asking about, that part of the bill says that those 5 MPOs, save Metro, will, assuming the bill passes, go on a schedule of reviewing the urban growth boundary and their residential land needs at no later than every 10 years. Currently, Metro has such a requirement. It's currently 5 years Representative Dingfelder's committee passed out a bill here not long ago that would extend that to 7 years for a partial, temporary extension. That's the only MPO, that's the only large city that has such a requirement in statute. It seems to us, especially given the situation that developed in Eugene-Springfield, that a similar requirement made sense. We tried not to make it onerous. One of the other things the amendments will do is reduce the burden on those other MPO jurisdictions. Most of them, I believe, are already doing this or something very similar to it. I don't think this adds anything new to them. It simply prevents another situation, such as what's happening in Lane County, from developing in the future. The Springfield-Eugene portion of the bill, Section 3, essentially what we're trying to say with this is that these two jurisdictions should plan their urban growth boundary and their urban land needs separately. Transportation planning should remain cooperative. Water planning, stormwater planning, everything else remains part of the regional comprehensive plan, but the land need analysis needs to remain separate. And the reason for this, frankly, goes back a bit of history. In 1995, this legislature passed House Bill 2709, which is codified 197-260-296 at SEC, as they say, and that sets up the 20-year land supply requirement. At the time that bill was passed, it said in its language, and I put this in my written testimony, it applied at the next to the large cities in the state at periodic review, the next periodic review, or the next review of the urban land supply. At the time that bill was passed, Eugene and Springfield were in periodic review in 1995. Eugene and Springfield are still in periodic review, the same periodic review in 2007. There's no sense getting in a rush on these things, apparently, and so 12 years later, they're still doing the same periodic review, so technically, they would not be required to do an urban land analysis until their next periodic review, which might be 2017. Now, we have, and the home builders in Lane County, at the state level, the city of Springfield, have very significant concerns about the land supply in the Eugene-Springfield urban growth boundary. The last analysis was done in 1995. It is 12 years old. It had a shortfall then. We believe the shortfall is worse. Much of the land, as you'll hear from other witnesses, within the current urban growth boundary is very steep, very difficult to build on. It is having an impact on surrounding communities. And under this legislation, we believe that addresses itself by simply allowing the planning process to continue. As you heard from the city of Springfield, they stand ready to do so, but under the current comprehensive plan requirements under which they're operating, they cannot do so unilaterally. They need the city of Eugene, which in January voted at the city council level to not entertain the land study. And to partially answer Mr. Chairman Representative Dingfelder's question of the last panel of witnesses, should this bill pass, it doesn't change anything about state law. All the density requirements, all the requirements to look inside the boundary first, all of that remains the same. It doesn't change a single thing about what the city of Springfield or Eugene would have to do if there's a land need identified. Separate planning doesn't necessarily make it any easier, in other words. In fact, under this bill, it doesn't mean they move the urban growth boundary. It simply means they do the analysis. And the problem that the Springfields had, and what this bill is attempting to address, is an inability to even get the analysis done. So never mind the urban growth boundary, we can't even run the numbers yet. We would like to do so. We think that's an appropriate step for these two communities. Frankly, there is a lot of disagreement between the two communities, as you may have gathered. They have different visions. Right? Neither one wants to, you know, force the other one to live by theirs. I think we can have two complementary views existing in Lane County just fine. Attached to my written testimony is an editorial from the Register Guard about this legislation. I think you'll find it instructive. I will leave it to you to read. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my testimony and take questions, unless you'd rather do so after Ms. Quayler.
We'll let you speak, and then we'll go for some questions.
Thank you. Roxy Quayler, Director of Government Affairs for the Lane County Home Builders Association, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. Basically, we've been concerned about the land supply for a number of years, and the situation has become acute because of the unique circumstances that John described to you. The jurisdictions were grandfathered in as far as having to exit periodic review with a 20-year supply, and we are still in the same periodic review that began 14 years ago. And the result is, I think that the periodic review literally is down to having DLCD sign some paperwork. But nobody is suggesting that we are leaving periodic review with an abundance of land. Best case scenario, we have about an 8.5-year supply of land. That assumes that every single bit of land becomes available in the next 8 years and is developed. And that's an unlikely scenario. The other problem is that the land is becoming increasingly constrained. We paid Land Council Government, LCOG, 2 years ago to do a slope analysis for us. The land is not only constrained with wetlands and things like that, but the slopes are becoming acute. Obviously, we developed easy stuff first. We're not silly. And what's left 2 years ago, Springfield especially is constrained. Out of the vacant low-density residential land in Springfield, 28% has a slope greater than 25%. Half has a slope greater than 15%, and that was 2 years ago. And that means that it's very expensive to develop. It used to be 10 years ago that the city of Springfield would tell us, would you please build some high-end houses? Everything we build now is high-end houses because we can't build inexpensive houses anymore. By the time you excavate, put in your foundation, you can have $225,000 before you start framing. And by no one's definition is that affordable housing. We need some land that is more agreeable to building than the extreme slopes that we're facing, especially in Springfield. The difficulty for Springfield is that while it's recognized the need, as other people have testified, the Eugene City Council has decided that it will not do a land study until required to do so by the state. And the next periodic review, because we haven't finished this one that we started 14 years ago, will probably not be ordered until the year 2014 at the soonest, and we're scheduled to run out of land in the year 2015. And therein lies the problem. So the idea is to do good planning, get some land studies done in the Eugene-Springfield area, let the individual jurisdictions, Eugene and Springfield, decide what type of growth policies within reason they want to have, but get the planning started. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Bob Rindy from DLCD and Dan Eisen. I always said it wrong.
Eisenbeis.
Thanks, Eisenbeis. Thanks, Dan.
This is better than the Cougar Mall.
I just feel like I'm in a domestic law attorney watching the divorce case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I have some written comments that I'm having passed to you today. Generally, we talk about two things in these comments. The department, first of all, wants to just remind you that last session, in response to a work group established the previous session, the legislature made some substantial changes to periodic review. And part of this, a lot of this was in response to some of the testimony you just heard about local governments that were spending a very long time in periodic review on a variety of issues. The legislation was a result of a work group. We had on the work group a broad consensus to change periodic review to focus on urban growth issues, such as we're talking about today, and to focus periodic review on large jurisdictions and establishing certain timelines for periodic review. For large jurisdictions, such as Eugene and Springfield, the timelines were 7 years. Every 7 years, those from the date they finished completing periodic review, those local governments must start again. So the first comment we make is I don't know why we would want to change it to 10 years at this point, and I don't think the sponsors are really intended that. I think the point is that we have finally got established a schedule that makes a lot of sense for large urban jurisdictions to examine the land supply every 7 years. That's separate from Portland Metro, by the way, which has its own schedule. So in regards to Section 2, we don't think it's necessary. We also note that the MPOs that are listed in Section 2, besides Metro, all of them, I think except for Eugene Springfield, are either have just completed or are currently doing the work that this bill describes. So I don't think there's a problem that we solve with Section 2. Section 3, and I think a later section, is about Eugene and Springfield. And there we do concur that as a result of periodic review that has now been changed, but the fact that Eugene Springfield has been in periodic review for such a long time, and indeed the order to complete that is on the desk of the manager of that section, and we're done now. That means Eugene and Springfield will start periodic review again 7 years from now. But as part of their periodic review, they actually did the land supply in 1995. That's a long time ago when you consider that not only is it more than 10 years from today, it's going to be another 7 years until they do it again. So we are concurring that it makes some sense for the legislature to require that joint urban growth boundary begin to conduct and within a reasonable period of time complete the analysis to replenish the land supply in the Eugene Springfield UGB, make that a 20-year supply. We are concerned, though, that this bill would do that, make that an exercise that's done separately by the two jurisdictions. It's our understanding that Springfield approached Eugene and asked that they jointly conduct this supply. They couldn't get that. You can order that through this bill. But if you order it to be done separately, we're going to see, I think at the end, we're going to have something to untangle on our desk and on LCDC's desk, and that's going to be these two local governments are going to come in, I would predict, probably with different assumptions, maybe vastly different assumptions about the growth needs of that common area. And that's going to make us put us in a tough bind in terms of if we approve one of those sets of assumptions, it may conflict with the other one. I think it's best to recraft this bill to require that they begin this analysis, but they do it as they have always done it, which is as a joint exercise. Both local governments would evaluate the land supply, and that will take care of some of the other technical difficulties that arise from the drafting of this bill. Because as it's drafted now, once Springfield or Eugene separately complete their analysis, you've still got 298, which isn't really mentioned in this bill, that's going to require both those local governments to look for the least valuable farmland around the entire UGB, i.e. in the neighboring jurisdiction, and they're probably not going to get what they want anyway. So I think to sum up, what we're recommending is you don't need Section 2. It probably makes good sense to require that UGB be evaluated in the near future, but we would urge you to have that done as a joint exercise as it's been done in the past. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to take questions.
Okay. Representative Boakley.
Thank you, Chair. Bob, just trying to get educated because we were worried about unintended consequences. Could you explain the Corvallis, if you know, the Corvallis metropolitan area, new one to me, and the Medford and the Bend? Medford, I got a grasp of, I think, but Bend metropolitan area?
What I was trying to describe there is MPOs, metropolitan planning organizations. There's a complex definition, and I'm not going to be able to cite it to you without having it in front of me, but there are six of these designated statewide. One of them is Bend. In some cases, those MPOs include more than one jurisdiction. I think Corvallis includes Philomath. I think Medford includes one or two of the outlining jurisdictions. That's another technical difficulty with this. Right now, those smaller cities don't have to follow 296. 296 is a complex set of requirements for larger jurisdictions. Section 2 of this bill implies that all of a sudden now those smaller jurisdictions are also under 296. I think that's unintended, but there's several unintended things in the drafting of this, but I really don't believe you need Section 2 because I think that the revamped periodic review, which technically goes into effect this summer, is from now on going to require 7 years between the UGB analysis for all the large MPOs, including Eugene, starting now. And I see no reason to statutorily change that to 10 years.
One follow-up. So then, understanding your suggestion on Section 2 and Section 5, I believe Section 6 actually is one of the things that the Dash 1 would amend. And in it would then exclude metropolitan service. metropolitan service districts organized under there, would this dash one then exclude Corvallis, Medford, and Bend, in your opinion, or?
I don't believe, Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, I don't believe that's the intent of this amendment, but I haven't, I'm not the author of this. I think the intent is to make it doubly, triply sure that we're not talking about the Portland Metro. But I think Section 2 does apply to the MPOs that include Bend, Corvallis, Medford, Salem, Kaiser, Eugene, Springfield.
Okay. Representative
Ingalls, if you did it.
Well, I had a question for Bob regarding the seven-year. So this was adopted. Was it last session or two sessions ago?
Last session.
And what? What consequences are there if a jurisdiction does not conduct their review within 7 years? I mean, is it they don't get local grants? And what? You know, we don't. I'm assuming have penalties for the jurisdictions. But what? You know, what can we do to make sure that is actually enforced? I mean, what tools did the department have or the legislature have?
The Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, the statute requires that the jurisdictions do that. It does give LCDC enforcement authority. In other words, there's an enforcement order section of ORS 197 that authorizes LCDC to enforce, and there are a variety of tools the Commission has, including withholding of state share revenues. Very, very rarely has it ever been used. I don't think there's, you know, example of a city that says, well, we're required by law to go into periodic review, but we refuse. The problem has been that cities do take a long time to complete periodic review. And that's what that means is if a city takes an inordinate amount of time in periodic review, it's going to be that much longer till they get to the next one. And that's the situation we're in with Eugene Springfield. It has been a very long time since they did the buildable lands analysis as part of the periodic review they just completed. It's been 7 years since they actually did that. And I think in 95 what they found is that the land supply was sufficient. But it's reasonable to conclude that probably the entire area ought to re-examine that supply before, what will it be, 2015 or whatever it's going to be right now. And so for that reason, we don't oppose the section that requires those local governments to do that. I think it should be done and should probably start fairly soon. I will note that periodic review brings with it grant funding that the legislature gives to the department to disperse. Under this bill, it's not clear that funding would be available to the local governments. So there's probably a fiscal to this from the sense that Eugene and Springfield will be required to do something they wouldn't otherwise have to do. We would attempt to fund it through some of our other grant funding, but I can't guarantee that will happen.
Thank you.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me in a question. Sure. I guess one comment is that Springfield has been participating right now in an inventory on residential, of which they're paying. There's a joint payment there going on. So I don't think that's the issue. I think it's just the fact that we can't, you know, you just can't work it in the cooperation agreement that we have, or non-cooperation agreement that we have. I don't know. But under Section 3, why would you think that it would be that much worse to be planning on an individual basis than doing the joint and then just dumping it on you to let you navigate through the rest of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I think it would be there'd be a couple of things that are downsides that I did point out in the letter. The Big Look Task Force, which is examining closely urban growth boundary policy statewide and will present legislature next time with recommendations. They've spent a great deal of time discussing ways to try and get Oregon's land use planning program to be more regional. That planning should be done more regionally rather than on individual case-by-case basis. Now, they haven't concluded their recommendations. I can't say today that's going to be their recommendation, but I suspect it's going to be a large part of it. And so at this time, we are a little concerned that effectively what this does is separate probably the last remaining piece. There's still pieces of that plan that are regional, but as you heard from the testimony, the cities individually plan for certain things, can make plan amendments, and now with this they would be able to separate their boundaries. We're essentially separating that plan. It is now a regional plan. I think it's a wonderful model for statewide. I'm sad too that it's come to this dispute, and all I'm saying is one way to maybe resolve this dispute is to make both jurisdictions examine the boundary and respond as if there is indeed a land shortage to replenish that land supply. But if it's possible to do that together, we would prefer to see it done that way than separately. If it's done separately, you're correct. We can try and sort it out in the end, and I'm afraid that's going to be complicated, and would prefer not to see it that way.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up?
Yes.
I'm not really sure how it gets more complicated.
if I could, for example, right now there is a single coordinated forecast for housing needs for a population for the Eugene Springfield area. The assumptions for the density of housing, one of the things we were talking about, types of housing and everything else, it's the same. Those two jurisdictions side by side will present us with the same assumptions and one forecast for land needs for 20 years when they're done with this exercise. If it's done separately, I know that what we're going to see is two probably completely different sets of forecasts, maybe even down to the point of population. I'm not sure. I mean, part of that depends on how a strong hand Lane County wants to play in enforcing the jurisdictions to coordinate. It could come out okay. I am concerned that it probably will come out that we've got what we will see is an analysis that includes widely divergent forecasts for the long term for those two areas, and we will somehow have to assemble them into one, and LCDC will in evaluating that decision down the line. And as I said, we can do that. It's just we're expressing our preference that it would be, I think, a far better thing if they were to both do it together as they did when they created the boundary. There's a lot of assumptions for land supply in that boundary that probably reflect the fact that both local governments agreed on those assumptions early on. Somehow they're going to have to pull it all apart. I think pulling all the different pieces of that plan apart to create two separate UGBs is going to be a very complex exercise, far more complex than if the local governments were to do it together as they started.
Just one quick.
Okay.
But it could be done.
Could be done.
Thank you.
I had a question, Mr. Chair, although I realize we've got maybe other things that...
Yeah, a few more of these people on two more bills, but that's okay.
Okay.
It's important
Mr. Ridley, the model I'm most familiar with is the Portland Metro government, regional government, which basically decides what the urban growth boundary will be, and it does not try to broker an agreement among the various jurisdictions within the Portland metropolitan area. And so drawing on that model, that seems like the right model for Eugene Springfield is some regional government. In this case, the logical player is the county, Lane County. Why wouldn't Lane County play the same role with respect to these issues with the same authority that the metro regional government has in the Portland area to resolve these competing visions about how the boundary ought to expand?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, it would be the only case where the legislature had given a county that authority. And in the case of Metro, there's a long set of statutes that establish Metro's authority to establish that boundary. I think they do work closely with all the local governments and end up brokering a lot of agreements, but they are clearly put in that seat to make those decisions. There's no parallel case in Eugene Springfield or in the other case where we have a mutual boundary, which is Salem Kaiser, where the county is given that authority. If you did that, I guess, well, I would have to think it through. I don't know what the ramifications are, but it would be the first time you'd ever done that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Dan.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Dan Eisenbeiss, Legislative Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. In the interest of time and recognizing you have a lot to get through, I'll keep my remarks very brief. It seems that the primary issue that this bill attempts to address is making sure that Oregon's metropolitan areas have an up-to-date buildable lands inventory. 1,000 Friends of Oregon supports requiring that our largest metropolitan areas update their buildable lands inventories every 10 years. However, we have to oppose the provision that would essentially allow Eugene and Springfield to go their own ways, and their Section 2, or at least our reading of Section 2, appears that it may allow communities in other metropolitan areas to go their own way as well. The fact of the matter is that growth management and transportation planning in metropolitan areas attempt to address the way that metropolitan areas function, where housing markets, commercial and industrial land markets are all intertwined, and people live in one community while working in another, travel between. If this bill went forward and allowed Springfield and Eugene to conduct their own buildable lands inventory, I think that we would see quite a few problems arise down the road in terms of disagreement or expansions of the urban growth boundary on one side of the urban growth boundary that may undercut the intentions and plans of the other local jurisdiction within the UGB. Certainly things are not working as well as they could or perhaps should in the Eugene Springfield area, but I would urge the committee to look at ways to make sure that the buildable land supply or inventory that's in use in that metropolitan region as well as in other regions of the state is up to date or current. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both. We're going to try to get through all this, and we have two other bills, and we don't have a lot of time. So I'm going to ask people to hold their comments down, and we'll see how we do with questions. So the next two, Bill, is it Close? And Dan Egan?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bill Close. It's a pleasure to be here. I have a two-page letter that's been distributed with a one-page attachment, which is a little table, summary table. My two-page letter says mostly the kinds of things you've heard so far, so I won't repeat them. My background is that I've been doing exclusively land use law in Eugene Springfield area for the last 26 years. Which is a long time. It's not that the subject matter is intrinsically exciting, it's just that after I was in it for a while, I realized I didn't have any other marketable skills. and so I'm still doing it. And I friends say to me, so, Bill, when are you going to retire? And I say, well, I'm going to retire as soon as they expand the urban growth boundary for Eugene Springfield, and the litigation over that is over. And they look at me and they laugh, and I say, no, I'm pretty serious. I said, I've got a 13-year-old daughter. She's got to go to college, and I need for her to be sending big checks home. And, you know, the way I figure it is, about eight, the way we're path we're on now, it's going to take about 8 years to expand the UGB, and then it'll take about 7 years to finish the litigation over that, the way we're structured right now. So that's 15 years, and by that time she'll be out of college and sending checks home. The table that's in the back of my testimony is my summary table that kind of documents our frozen urban growth boundary. And I this is stuff you might not hear from other folks, so I'll just walk you through this a little bit. The urban growth boundary we have now, we got in 1980 when we adopted the Metro Plan. And that was the year before I started practice. It got acknowledged in 1982. I'm kind of walking down my table there. We had our first periodic review in 1985. Our second periodic review, 12 years running, was started in May 25th, 1995. Just before the effective date of your legislation that said, hey, y'all need to have a 20-year supply of buildable land. Okay, so your House Bill 2996 became effective in September of 1995. That's your 20-year land supply statute. So the rest of the world's been operating under that statute for 12 years now. State's got a pretty good track record. In 2005, the LCDC agreed with the City of Eugene and said, this is in a periodic review work task order, said, since your periodic review started just before the effective date of House Bill 2996, you're exempt. You don't need a 20-year supply. You get a free ride. I got that footnoted to the LCDC order. That was a big win for the City of Eugene. In 2006, in the context of another piece, LCDC reviewing another piece of the periodic review work program, Goal 5 package, the LCDC agreed that the cities did not need to revisit their buildable land supplies. And I was at that hearing, and the chairman of the LCDC said, we're agreeing with our staff, you don't have to revisit the buildable land supplies, I'm closing the hearing. And then the chair turned and said to all the assembled masses from the various cities, said, now, go back home and tell your bosses that you're really short on land and you better get things straightened out. You know, kind of a shock of cognitive dissonance there for us folks that are trying to work the program. I have in there that the second periodic review ended in 2007. And in fact, it's going to end in 2007. As Bob Rindy says, that piece of paper is ready to sign at the LCDC as soon as spring breaks over. Okay, so now you get to the shaded part of my table there, which is looking into the future. Estimated start of the next periodic review. The current rules that I looked at it on the LCDC website said 10 years, so I'm putting it at 2017. Maybe it's going to get bumped down to 7 years, so it's really 2014. And estimated completion of the third periodic review, I'm indulging the assumption that they're going to get through the next periodic review in half the time it took them to get through this one. So that puts us at 2023. We will be at 43 years at that point with the same urban growth boundary. We're at 27 years right now, no questions asked. And so I think that's the gist of this bill. The system is not working, and we need some legislative intervention. And I don't want to talk about the details of this bill, but we need a fix. I'd like to respond to a couple points that were made earlier in this testimony. I realize I'm running on. I'm really used to the 3 minutes you get in front of the city, Eugene City Council. Response to Representative Dingfelder's comments, we're not talking about doing something different here. We're really talking about getting Eugene Springfield caught up with the rest of the state, which has had to comply with this House Bill 2096, 20-year land supplies for the last 12 years. We're not doing it yet. It's a catch-up game. The reference made to one of the externalities of the frozen UGB. One of the externalities is growth goes out to the collar communities. Literally, 70 to 80% of the work I'm doing right now is in the collar communities. Cottage Grove, Junction City, Cresswell, and so on, Veneta. These communities are reeling from the growth they're getting. They're becoming commuter cities. Which means Goal 12 issues coming into play, Goal 13 issues coming into play as people commute back and forth, but there's no mechanism for getting at those problems. It's just an ad hoc decision, have a frozen UGB, and you know, let the chips fall where they may. They're falling on the collar communities. A comment about DLCD. I was a little confused by some of Bob Rindy's comments. I heard the suggestion that, well, maybe this should be solved through periodic review, and we're shortening up periodic review. He recognizes it's a real problem with their land supply in the cities. LCDC could have speeded up the periodic review process. It's taken 12 years, and if they really had the whip out, it would have been done in a much shorter period of time. Basically, the local communities are just able to let it roll for whatever reason. Secondly, the LCDC had several opportunities late in this periodic review process to say you need to revisit the buildable land supply. And I'm kind of struck by LCDC showing up here now in 2007 when in 2005 and 2006 they explicitly said to the cities in periodic review, you're okay, we're not going to make you revisit the land supply. What's changed? And my final comment has to do with the suggestion I heard in Mr. Rindy's testimony about telling the local governments that they need to cooperate and do a single land study. And I don't understand why I heard him say that if we make them do that, the product we're going to get on the table at the end of the process is going to be unworkable. I agree with that completely. Secondly, I think the mechanics of doing it separately is not that difficult. You know, I-5, it's a great conceptual concrete dividing line. So you let each community be responsible for its population projections, which have to be coordinated through the county with everybody else, but have their own population projections, do the needs analysis, and then figure out their land supply and put two separate packages on LCDC's table. It seems workable to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair and committee members, thank you for the time here. I'll try to keep my comments very brief. I'm Dan Egan. I'm the executive director of the Springfield Chamber of Commerce. We have about 750 members representing about 42,000 workers in the Eugene Springfield area. I've had that position since 1995. That year has come up a few times in conversation here. I guess a couple of points from the private sector point of view here. We've been concerned about the land inventories, not just residential, but commercial and industrial for quite a long time. Companies and people need land. Where they work and where they live take land. And we have seen in Springfield a way different city post-1995 than pre-1995. It's been a great time for me to work there at a Chamber of Commerce. The 1995 was the year that Sony Disc Manufacturing opened the facility in the gateway area of Springfield. Now, in that short time between then and now, we've added nearly, and will add with the construction of the Peace Health Regional Hospital, nearly 30,000 employees. This was after a decade of almost stagnant growth in Springfield. Cities change, and Springfield has changed. It's used up its land. It's used up the land that would be shovel-ready for industrial uses, places for all manner of employees to work. Royal Caribbean is there with a very large call center. Symantec is there with a very large center. We have more diversity of folks at different wage points than we ever have in the history of our city. And it's demanded a lot of different kinds of responses. We have a more complex city. And I think, you know, for a lot of folks, and I'll let my colleague from Eugene Chamber speak for the Eugene side, but on the Springfield side, we've long recognized that we needed a little bit more say over our own inventory of lands so that we can accommodate what we see as continued growth, robust growth, not only in the job market, but in indeed a demand for folks to live close to where they work. I've heard a lot about, you know, pushing people to these other communities. There's a high cost for that. There's also sort of a loss of the metro center sense of that. And so from the private sector point of view, what I'd like to continue to say to employers like Royal Caribbean, Symantec, others who are coming to look at Springfield, we have a place for your company. We have a place for your employees as well. We are going to continue to grow, but we need the land and the ability to have some certainty over that as well. Economic development and housing for what follows robust economic development needs to have some market certainty. And this bill helps to, for Springfield, to start to guide, however easily, its own course for its land use. I would also say that I've heard a couple of comments about, you know, things that could go wrong. Springfield's a pretty good success story in this state, having been a single industry town for a very long time. I would hope that there would be some level of hope and trust that the city would be very prudent and very responsible to continue to diversify and grow its economy, continue to attract families to the town. It's a good story in the state of Oregon, and we need some control to continue the story. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both. We'll have Jim Welch and Harlan Levy. And again, we'll ask you to paraphrase what you're going to say and keep it as short as you can.
Yes.
Thanks.
Chair Roblin and committee members, I'm Jim Welch. I'm government affairs director for all four realtor associations in Lane County, and I do their government affairs work at the local level. And having grown up in this county, born in Eugene, you know, there's some political and philosophical realities that I think we have to recognize here. And you talk about unintended consequences when you would separate, as this bill would, possibly just for planning usefulness, you know, unintended consequences. Well, I would invite you to come down and stay with us for a weekend and during the week, especially when you have the rush hours from what Bill Kloos is calling the collar communities out there. I live in one of those, Elmira. And the unintended consequences of the battle, the political battle, philosophical battle going on between two jurisdictions, has what we have today, a marriage that is not working. And I guarantee you this is a marriage that was not made in heaven. And the political realities there are that we're going to have to do something, and that's why we're here today asking for and supporting, and certainly the realtors support this legislation at the local level. In fact, we didn't in time get a letter to Oregon Association of Realtors supporting this from Cresswell. Cresswell said we want to support that because there are some things that unintended consequences down there, growth being pushed out to Cottage Grove, Cresswell, other areas. And I just want to make a couple points here in some of the realities that we're seeing there. We got a veto on a transportation plan to the west that would take us to the 126 corridor, one which Chair Roblin, and I'm sure you have traveled a few times as well as I have, and through this organization, that was vetoed. We have 650 new housing development, new starts for Vinita alone, just approved, 650. We have three new developments being in the process of being approved for Junction City. You see the problem we're facing for another a need for metro planning, for regional planning as transportation. Because a lot of these people are working in Eugene and Springfield, and they're going to continue to do that. We have three members of this metro organization do not play well in the sandbox together. We are going to have to come up with a solution, and this is the closest that we can imagine because we've continued to urge several of those partners to give us a solution locally. It has not come, and you've heard all the reasons, all the realities, and that I'll end with and hope that you can help us.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'll be very brief. We support this bill and want to thank Representative Beyer for bringing it forward and hope that this committee favorably considers it. And that's it. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Terry Connolly, Eugene Chamber, and Alex, is it Collier? Tyler from City Eugene, and I think that's everybody.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. My name is Terry Connolly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. We appreciate this opportunity to comment on House Bill 3337. I'm here today on behalf of the Eugene Chamber to speak in support of House Bill 3337. We believe this bill is a good step in the right direction to improving and maybe even preserving land use planning in Eugene Springfield metropolitan area. As an organization that places a high priority on promoting and supporting responsible economic development, we maintain that wise land use planning is an essential element to successful economic development. The value of this bill is it will enable Eugene and Springfield to update their buildable land inventories on a more consistent and predictable basis than otherwise has been the case. This data then becomes a very helpful tool for each jurisdiction, and our metro community as a whole to make good planning decisions with respect to future public facilities and infrastructure, housing, and employment needs. Additionally, because planning decisions made without benefit of timely or buildable lands inventory data can affect nearby communities, this bill will be useful with respect to regional planning as well. Notwithstanding the fact employers in our community worry about the limited supply of industrial and commercial land, they also have a keen interest in residential land supplies because their ability to attract and retain workers can be influenced by where the workforce lives or can afford to live. Therefore, there is an economic development value in House Bill 3337. Also, just as there is a value to local and state government to have coordinated land use and transportation plans, which is another benefit from the data this bill will produce, there is an economic development value to align housing and jobs. Again, employers need to know where the workforce will live or can afford to live. In conclusion, we think this bill is a good step in the right direction to ensure that cities like Eugene and Springfield have the buildable land inventory data they need in order to make good planning decisions for themselves and for the metro area as a whole. I would also like to say that the Dash 1 amendments that have been submitted, we do support those. And we would also offer that a lot has been said about the complexity of this may occur. We urge you to listen carefully to what the city of Springfield has said, that the real complexity may be if they reach the point where they essentially dissolve the metro plan or remove themselves. Then things would get really complex in our community. This bill keeps the metro plan intact, and that's something we can't stress enough for you to consider. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Roebling, members of the committee, and Representative Beyer, I'm Alex Kyler with the City of Eugene. With me today is Kurt Yeider. He's a senior planner with the Planning and Development Department. If you have any questions that I am likely unable to answer, I did want to indicate that I have presented you with some written testimony here today. However, that was prior to us receiving the Dash 1 amendment, and clearly that takes care of several of our concerns, but we still would typically need to take this back through our council process in order to get a formal position on those Dash amendments. I did want to point out, though, especially in response to the comments that Representative Dingfelder opened up asked during the earlier portion of the testimony, is that Eugene, as a result of a fairly constrained land supply, has actually seen a number of benefits to that in terms of urban infilling and downtown development. We, for the first time in our recent past, anyway, have several new projects in the downtown area that are for housing only. And we also are enjoying the benefit of an improved transportation corridor and planning system and kind of quasi-light rail system that connects Eugene and Springfield in order to service more people living in that compact, dense urban area. I have heard people speak to this push out to the rural areas and the impacts that that has had on rural communities, and I'm not sure that's so much of a push rather than a pull, really. I'm actually a resident of one of the more rural areas, a satellite town. I didn't go there because it was cheaper to live out there. It's actually probably more expensive for me to live out in the rural area, but I do it for other reasons. So we recognize that Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County have some challenges in terms of our ability to work together. However, state law has put us into that situation, and we prefer to work under the auspices of that law and go with the timelines that have been established under the law in terms of periodic review. We still feel like we're within the letter of the law in terms of where we are with periodic review.
Okay. Any questions?
I'm not even sure where to go with that one. Mr. Chair, I guess my only comment is there's a big difference, I think, in the choices of the communities. And I think that's the gist of this problem. Is that, and I will tell you, there's a lot of infill going on in Springfield now, too. I live in a community, I live in an area of new construction, and these are panhandle lots, you know, a lot of it, and there is maybe 15 feet in the backyard of one house, 5 feet between the side of that yard to the next house. I mean, it's going on, and these are choices people are making, whether they want to live in that constrained an area. We're also developing in our downtown area housing in that area. I mean, we're all doing what we have to do because we're forced into this situation, but that doesn't make it a good situation. It doesn't make it a good situation for our taxpayers, our residents in our communities. I just think that something has to be done, and whether or not it's Eugene agreeing to do inventories to really get a look at what the problem is, or whether we split off, because I think at some point those are the decisions that are going to be made, and we don't really want to sever all ties, but at some point that may have to be done.
Where have we come?
Definitely a comment. Thank you for...
So, any other questions for these two? Thank you very much. We're going to... I'm not even going to ask. We're going to close the hearing on 3337, and we're going to open a public hearing on 3436. And I'm willing to stay a little longer just to finish up. There's only about four people on these other two bills.
So. I have a meeting at 5 o'clock, so I'll just go.
I can stay. We don't have Measure 37 tonight, right?
I'll just be presenting to Arnie. That's okay.
I'll just be presenting
to you.
I'll
be there, too. I'll be there, too. It won't take too long. Which one did I just say? 34, 36?
Yeah. Oh, do we have a meeting set up for...
No, he's going to get brief. So we're doing 3436, and right here we have Linda. Did you also want...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right, yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I wish I had a riveting bill that was not complex, that did not deal with land use issues, to follow up on that last discussion, but I don't. I'll try to be very, very brief in explaining this bill. You're getting some written testimony handed out. I'm not going to go through that written testimony, but I'm going to give you a quick overview. That's really for reference purposes only. House Bill 3436 is intended to do two things. It's intended to put into legislation the rulemaking language that was completed by LCDC last fall that gave cities the ability to generate a population forecast for their city when either the county had never done one or that forecast was more than 10 years old. Additionally, on that line, several individual counties during this rulemaking process supported the concept of allowing cities to generate their numbers, but wanted to ensure that those numbers would be deemed coordinated as per the statutory requirement. And you'll see that down in Section 1, Sub 4 of the bill. Section 1, Sub 1 and 2 is the rulemaking portion that was done by DLCD. The second thing the bill does is to add a time certain for counties to respond within 6 months when a city generates a number for county review or adoption. And that's in Section 1, Sub 3 of the bill. Okay. Real quickly, what is the coordinated population forecast and why are these numbers important? Senate Bill 100 gave counties the authority in ORS 195-036 to coordinate the population forecast in the rural and urban portions of their counties. These numbers are the foundations for meeting the rest of the state's planning requirements. That includes land supply analysis, transportation system plans, we know as TSPs, urban growth boundary adjustments, and amendments school planning, even our water conservation management plans, all start with the city's 20-year population forecast. State statutes require counties to maintain this forecast, but they provide no remedy if it's not completed or kept timely. Last fall, there was a rulemaking that was done by LCDC for Goal 14, urbanization, and a significant number of meetings were held in that work group for that rulemaking that included many of the usual stakeholders in the land use process. Myself, Mr. Brierley, that's with me, Association of Oregon Counties, Thousand Friends, Home Builders Association, Association of Realtors, state agency representatives, land use consultants, and an assorted variety of other folks. There were new rules that implemented some new provisions for urbanization in Goal 14. In this process, a survey was conducted that indicated more than half the 36 counties in the state had either never adopted a coordinated population forecast or the forecast that they had done was more than 10 years old. So that was very, very concerning to myself and members of the work group. LSC advocated for new rules allowing cities to be able to proceed with generating their own forecast for comprehensive planning purposes when the county had not followed through with this. These rules were ultimately adopted, but they require action by adoption by the counties with no incentives for timely actions. And in the handout, you'll see the language of the new rule. It's substantially the same as the language of the top part of the bill. So why is timely action in these processes important to cities? Using UGB expansions as an example, delays cost impacts in the available land supply, which oftentimes lead to escalating land prices, particularly in fast-growing regions. I want to cite the city of Redmond as an example. Over the course of time delays in their population coordination forecast, they had a land that escalated within the boundary that tripled in cost from about $100,000 an acre to $300,000 an acre. They estimate that land outside the boundary likely doubled in that time. Again, this is a fast-growing community, but this underscores why delays are very problematic. Given that cities are required to process development applications within 120 days, and counties have a similar requirement within 150 days, my thoughts were that 180 days, which is in the bill for response by counties when cities do generate a number, seem quite reasonable. Many cities that need to expand their UGBs or to accommodate growth, take advantage of development opportunities, think that it's very important to have accurate population numbers every 5 to 6 years. I'm thinking about Central Oregon in that place in years, but other cities such as the city of Medford feel very similarly. Let me talk a little bit about discussions that happened in the work group regarding this issue, and particularly incentives versus enforcement actions versus legislation. During the rulemaking process and since that time, I've suggested to work group members and to our county representatives an option of providing greater incentives for county to complete and or update their population forecasts, such as utilizing the local government grant funding provided by DLCD to hire either Portland State University or an independent demographer to provide initial numbers to cities and counties using accepted methodologies to help cities and counties go through that coordination process. I've also suggested at the last local government grants committee meeting last week, of which I'm a member, that if a county was to apply for a grant, that they also receive an additional grant with a requirement to comply with the population forecast requirement if it hadn't been completed or updated. These suggestions have both been turned down. However, we did discuss making coordinated population forecasts a priority of the grants program, but I do have to report to you that in the last 2 years, we've received one request from a single county to do that work. money has always been available to counties to do that work, and I've seen very, very few of those requests, and I've been a member of that grants committee since its inception. So lastly, I want to suggest that simple enforcement action for not complying with the county statutory requirements that have been in place for at least 20 years has also been suggested by some members of the Goal 14 work group. And there's ample statutory guidance for this, which I've passed out to you. But to date, the League has been reluctant to seek enforcement action as a remedy. So my thoughts are this. This issue is apparently not just about resources or that grants committee would have received more applications over the course of the last 6 years for grant assistance. While other factors come into play, such as local politics and complications, absolutely, such as Measure 37 claims, population forecasting is not a rocket science, and it's not a science of perfection. There's always ample opportunity to come back at a later date, make adjustments, or fine-tuning as circumstances dictate. While county inaction is not the only reason that can cause delay in the resolve of population forecasts, I feel that we do need to do everything we can to ensure a timely and streamlined process. I think this is going to be particularly important as we move toward the future, and many of our communities are forecasted actually to grow and increase in population and need these numbers to be able to do their appropriate analysis for housing and everything else they do with their comprehensive plans. This bill doesn't provide all the answers, but I think if we fail to make this situation better, lost opportunity costs over time are a waste of some of the essential community resources that could be put into far better use. Thank you for your time and the consideration of the bill. As a technical person, I brought with me today Barton Brierley. He's the planning director for the city of Newburgh. He's a past president of the Oregon City Planning Directors Association, and he was a Goal 14 work group member. He does have a story to tell about his experience with population forecasting.
Thank you. I'd like to share with you our experience with coordinating population projections. And I'd like to share that with you. I don't think
you're going to introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Barton Brierley. I'm the planning director for the city of Newburgh and past president of the Oregon City Planning Directors Association.
Thanks.
I'd like to share with you our experience. I don't think our experience is unique, and the problems that we've experienced are unique. As you've heard in earlier the discussions, the process to amend your urban growth boundaries, sometimes lengthy process can go on for a long time, and I hope it will be done before my daughter's done with college. Our experience, a few years ago, the city found a need to update its urban growth boundary. We had an urban growth boundary that was projected to meet our needs through 2010, which I don't think is a 20-year supply. And so we knew that we needed to go through the process, and the first thing we needed to do was to create new population projections, because that's the basis for all the other work that you do. We consulted with the county. The county had coordinated population projections for all the cities in the county up to 2012, which it still isn't a 20-year land supply. So we did something to create new population projections. We did something pretty radical, which is we hired a professional demographer from Portland State University Center for Population Research to give us a population report based on the best science that's available. He gave us a report, and we gave that report to the county, and the county looked at it, didn't have any particular problems with or objections to the numbers that were in the report. They just weren't sure what kind of process they'd go through to coordinate that. We took that number, took it to the community. It was accepted through a number of public forums, ultimately adopted by the city council, and accepted by DLCD through the post-acknowledgement plan amendment process. Based on that, we spent the $100,000 or so to do the big books of studies that you need to do to do land needs and future economic opportunity analysis and all that sort of work.
We got through all of that and went to the county and said, well, we just need to tie up this one loose end. We still need you to sign off on our population projection. They said, yeah, they didn't really have any objection, but they still weren't sure what kind of process they were going to go through to do the population coordination. So we moved ahead. We did a proposal for the urban growth boundary, held about 50 public meetings to talk to people about how we should grow. And we actually had a hearing, and it was universally accepted. We had zero people speak in opposition to our urban growth boundary. We still had the one little tiny thing out there was that the county still hadn't coordinated our population projection. We went to the county and said, well, we'll coordinate it for you if you'd like. And so we did. We went to all the cities in the county and said, you know, here's our numbers. You have any objections? Finally, over 2.5 years after we'd given the numbers to the county, we got a letter saying that they would accept that as a coordinated population projection. All that to say that the bill before you, I believe, would make the process quicker, especially on the front end where it's critical before you spend the $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000, and it would make it give you more certainty in what you do so that you can proceed with that work knowing that that basic information will be accepted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
And next we have Art Schlack and Bob Rindy. Might as well both come on up.
Get up here, Art. I want to hear your side of the story. That's right.
Also, the city of Eugene just legislated and wants to represent us and give us a proof for the next thing.
I guess so.
I'll go first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here to testify on House Bill 3436. Mr. Chair, just like families, sometimes you have to agree to disagree. And unfortunately, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Association of Oregon Counties does not agree and does not support House Bill 3436. The cornerstone of the Oregon Land Use Planning Program deals with or starts with population projections. And the statutes in 195.025, speaking to regional coordination, and I just want to quote that one section at this point, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence. It says, in addition to the responsibilities stated in ORS 197-175, each county, through its governing body, shall be responsible for coordinating all planning activities affecting land use within the county, including planning activities of the county, cities, special district, state agencies, to ensure integrated comprehensive plans for the entire area of the county. That's what the statute says is the county responsibility. And I believe, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the county does a good faith effort to carry out that responsibility. Could we do a better job, or could counties do a better job? Yes. There's no question about it. You can always do a better job at this point. The counties, a number of counties in the state have been doing population coordination in the metro area, Washington and Clackamas County. I could give you examples of Marion, Deschutes, and Douglas and Union counties that also have done recently population coordination. And their efforts take a considerable amount of time and resources to conduct those in coordinating with the cities and the jurisdictions that they have to do that coordination. As an example, Mr. Chair, in 2005, and reference has already been made to Redmond here this afternoon, 2005, Deschutes County completed its second coordinated forecast for their county in coordination with the cities after two appeals to that second. So the appeals and the hearings in that take a considerable amount of time. It took several years. And I would note that the city of Sisters and Redmond have used those forecasts to amend their UGB, and that Bend is currently in the process of doing that. And they'll probably have to do that potentially again in the very short term, because now they have a fourth city, which wasn't anticipated at the time they were doing their coordination. And all of a sudden now you've got to consider that new city, not an unincorporated area, as they have in the past. Douglas County is another example, and they did their own population forecast methodology. They started in 1995, and after appeals with LCDC and with the courts, they finally adopted their coordinated population forecasts for their county and cities in the year 2000, taking 5 years to complete that whole exercise. So I just want to note for the record that the number of counties have stepped to the plate, done their work. There are counties that are losing population. And there are some counties, therefore, that don't have a strong interest in doing this, given the fact that you're trying to stimulate economic development and maintain the livability of your community in those instances. I would note for you that the big look is ongoing, and certainly since population and coordination is a cornerstone, that's something that the big look should be, you know, should be looking at this area. And if there are to be, I'll say, adjustments in how coordination is done in the state, those recommendations should come out of that process. I too sat on the Goal 14 work group. I too sit on the Grants Advisory Committee. In fact, I chair it. So I have at least some knowledge of how this process goes. The League of Oregon Cities representative is correct that the grants process has not been used to fund coordination efforts in the state the last few years. And part of that reason for it is the Grants Advisory Committee develops recommendations to the department and LCDC in terms of priorities. And population coordination has not been a priority. So when jurisdictions look at, well, where can we do some work that's important to us, and where can we what kind of grants will be entertained successfully, you know, you look at those priorities and you say, okay, I'm going to target my, you know, any request and my work activity in those areas. It is, you know, the Grants Advisory Committee at this point has identified population coordination as a priority. We hope that DLCD and the Commission will embrace that. And we will encourage this opportunity for grant coordination in the near future. Mr. Chair, I could go on. I think you get my drift at this point, that this is something that there are some disagreements about, at least in terms of this legislation. I don't think we should put the rules necessarily at this point in time either in statute, because the big look may have recommendations that would change these. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would hope that you'd take a long, hard look at this. I think things are working, and I think we can develop some key incentives to maybe move forward without legislation at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. What I handed out to you, the page, which is labeled 660-024-0030, these are administrative rules that LCDC adopted indeed after two long, hard years of work group participation. I was staff to that group, and I know how much work everybody put into these rules. But what these rules essentially did, what we were trying to do, was to streamline the process whereby cities could expect to take a county coordinated population forecast and update it to the moment when a city was considering its urban growth boundary. If you think for a minute, Marion County adopted a coordinated forecast for all of its cities, I think about 5 years ago. It was a 20-year forecast. Today, if Staten wanted to or came due to amend their urban growth boundary, that forecast would only be a 15-year forecast. So we tried through these rules to create a process whereby Staten could take that 15-year forecast of the counties and turn it into a 20-year forecast, starting on that date. It makes a lot of sense. And there's two safe harbors in these rules. If you don't adopt this statute, everything that we've got in these rules will remain. My concern is this, and I apologize, I don't have these in these points in writing, and I'll try to get them to you as soon as I can. First of all, in drafting this legislation, the safe harbors that you see under Section 3 and 4 of my handout, you'll notice they're not identically copied into statute. When we get 20-30 interests into a room and we reach agreement, as we did on these rules, on a way to word something, there's a piece in there that everybody wanted to have. What we've done is we've codified parts of these into statute, and we've left some of those pieces out. And I don't honestly know whether that means our rules can remain in force with those pieces in effect, and so this new piece of legislation would have no adverse effect on our rules, and that would be fine. But I am concerned that it is different, and it does leave pieces out. And a court would find, therefore, that our rules are inconsistent with statute, and we would have to eject those pieces that were so important to reaching agreement. What those pieces had to do with, first of all, is citizen involvement. If a city comes up with its own forecast, it has to do so in a manner that involves notice and opportunity for comments, and ultimately, if it comes to that, appeals to LUBA and a way to get it settled. By leaving those pieces out of this statute, I'm not sure that that's required anymore. I'm afraid that what happens is if a city follows a safe harbor as per the statute, and regardless of what they do, whether they have hearings or not, it's deemed to comply because it omits those requirements in our rules. Section 3 is, though, the piece that I think brings this statute, this proposed bill, to your attention. It was part of was on our list until the very end, and it was simply a way by which a city, when it's done, could present their forecast after they've had the hearings to the county, and if the county didn't respond within 6 months, it would be deemed to comply. We don't oppose that. LCDC determined that it wasn't legal to adopt that the statute is clear, the county has to adopt the forecast, and if you look closely at our rules, it says the city and the county adopt it. So we're not opposed to bringing that in, as the League has done, but we ask the same question. Because Section 3 of the bill simply deems a forecast to comply by virtue of the county doing nothing within 6 months, does that eliminate all the opportunities that citizens, our department, or other agencies or other cities would have to normally have to ask for redress of that through the courts or through LCDC? It doesn't say, and so we're concerned about that drafting. Section 4, I think, is a bad idea. Section 4 simply says that if, let's say, there's four cities in Deschutes County, if the county has a forecast that they put together for 20-year forecast, if they put it together in the year 2000, and 10 years from now, they have a new forecast from Portland State, and the difference between that new forecast and what the individual cities have brought them in the interim, that if there isn't a mismatch there, then the county is deemed to have done its work. Well, unfortunately, only one city has brought its forecast to the county. So the counties would be deemed to have done the work that we just heard all the testimony on about, that isn't really being done everywhere. In other words, this provision would actually encourage counties to do nothing, and if only one city came in to that county with a new forecast and the county agreed to it, I think the county would meet number 4 and wouldn't have to do anything more under the statute in terms of coordinating the forecast for the rest of its cities. That's probably not the intent of Ford, but I think that's the result of Ford with the way that it's drafted. So I would urge you to either let's redraft this to get at whatever it is that the cities were intending, or let's eject that from this bill. If we're going to leave three, let's make it clear that we have a clear process to make sure there's an appeal to LCTC or to LUB if necessary. And for one and two, if we're going to put these in, let's make sure they include the features that LCTC had, because some of those features were vital to our agreements.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, Bo.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, one question.
Okay, Representative
Klein. Well, two questions, and I know we're late. In this sort of grant process and the prioritizing, am I understanding correctly that all the grant money was spent just on higher priorities rather than money being left on the table?
Mr. Chair, Representative Klein, that's correct. The grant money, all the grant money that the legislature provides is all allocated, and it's all spent at this point. And there, in fact, are a number of applications that are not funded because they're not deemed either something that can be achieved within the time frame. They might be incomplete. I mean, there may be some technical things, or they're not a priority at this point.
One more, Mr. Chair. This is for the department. So today I've heard in various other conversations, 37 annexations, and now this as something big look is going to bring solutions back. How likely is that? How's that going?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I know that the big look is not looking at Measure 37. I'm certain of that.
Yeah, this is just a random consideration.
There's a lot put on their plate, and I'm also concerned about the level of detail they're going to be able to reach. I do believe that one of the things they are looking most closely at is the question of urban growth boundaries. How do we make sure those have a sufficient supply? How do we make sure that those get updated? How can we be more regional in a number of other things? Those are things they're talking about. I think it's premature for me to guess what they'll actually bring the legislature next time.
All right. Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yep.
Representative Clem, if there is anything that is fundamental to this planning program that we've started in Oregon, it's the coordination. And, either I think the big look needs to review that and either validate the coordination efforts that we have and how we do coordination and that between county to county, county to state, with the cities, with the special districts, that whole thing, because if we don't have coordination, we might as well give up the planning at that point.
Get a divorce.
You can get a divorce.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler, you have a question?
If I might, very quickly.
Yep.
I missed all his testimony earlier, so I'm glad to see him back. Yeah. Sorry about that.
I won't go through that again. At 5:15, I'll happily praise it for you, Representative Clem. Chairman, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Homebuilder Association. You heard in an earlier bill what happens when people don't play nice with one another. And Mr. Schlack is correct, and Ms. Ludwig, one of the central points of the land use program is coordination. What the bill in front of you speaks to is what happens when that doesn't happen. And unfortunately, that is the case in many situations. From a development standpoint, these population forecasts are critical. Someone has to do them. If the counties can, they should. If they cannot, someone else should be allowed to. We'd be happy to work with anybody on amendments to this bill, but we think the concept behind it is very important, and we would urge its passage. Any questions? We'd be glad to take them.
5:15.
Excellent. A new strategy has been born.
Thank you. I will talk to some people about whether they should. If there's something that can be worked out to make this a little more agile. But after hearing these two testimonies, there is an issue with respect to these 20-year plans. And having been on a water board and knowing that how important a 20-year plan was for the building of the new dam, I mean, everything was developed on that. Again, it was difficult not to have an updated one. So, but we will close that hearing on House Bill. What was that one? 3436. We have one more that we could hear, and there's only one person testified. Up for that, a short hearing. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. We'll open a quick hearing on House Bill 3435. And we have Randy Henry.
Good bill should pass, right?
I agree, yeah. I have no idea what it's about, but it sounds great.
And even though it's an important bill, late in the day.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Now for something completely different.
Yep. Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Henry with the Oregon State Marine Board, here to talk about House Bill 3435. I will try to be brief, and I'll paraphrase what's being handed out to you. House Bill 3435 is an effort to clarify law enforcement options to help prevent introduction of invasive species in Oregon, specifically invasive species that can survive and thrive in Oregon's waterways. The Oregon State Marine Board has been a longtime supporter of educational efforts. We talk to voters directly many ways throughout the course of the year, and we've spent many years trying to explain the need to adopt clean boating strategies, prevent the spread of invasive species, and in general reduce any pollution or other materials going into our state's waterways. As you may know, invasive species can be very damaging to ecosystems, to fish and wildlife resources out there in the state. The Oregon Invasive Species Council was established by the legislature in 2001 and has developed into a proactive and effective organization that brings together local organizations, state agencies, and federal natural resource agency partners to work together to prevent the spread of invasive species on land and water. We've worked closely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Departments of Agriculture, Forestry, Portland State University, Sea Grant, the Nature Conservancy, and others on the council to identify activities that can help prevent the invasion of Oregon by non-native species. It is clear, after serving on the committee for several years, plus with my history with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in a past life, and as a lifelong resident of Oregon, that boats are a vector of some of Oregon's most damaging and threatening invasive species. A recent survey by Portland State University Center for Lakes and Reservoirs found that all lakes that were surveyed along the south coast that had a boat ramp had from 1 to 4 aquatic plant species already established there. Generally, the infestation was adjacent to the boat ramp. Lakes without boat ramps were less likely to contain invasive species. Of course, the lakes with boat ramps are typically more accessible than less developed lakes. But the presence of the boat ramp increases the odds of spreading of the species to other water bodies by boat and trailer. We work closely to educate other boaters about invasive species. We have many contacts through our publications through the course of the year. Most boaters are happy to clean their boats if they are aware of the problem, but some boaters need the force of law to raise awareness and to initiate action. This measure, we believe, will assist our efforts to further engage all boaters to do the right thing. Unfortunately, the concern that our waters are at risk is not an idle one. Diamond Lake is an excellent example of what an invasive species can do to a lake or a water body, a fishery or an ecosystem. $6 million and 10 years of effort, the lake has been reclaimed, we hope, and is in the process of rehabilitation. You may have heard that quagga mussels were recently found in Lake Mead in Nevada and Arizona and in Southern California. In fact, several Colorado River reservoirs are infested. California is so concerned that they have implemented an incident command structure under authority of the governor to respond to the threat to California waters. They are now considering dewatering the aqueduct that transports water from the Colorado River to Los Angeles for a period of up to several weeks to ensure that quagga mussels don't become established there. This is at a cost of many millions of dollars, as you can imagine. It's a difficult process to get into this sort of situation. Two divers have already died in the effort to quantify the infestation in California waters, and a lot of work is ongoing. To our knowledge, quagga and zebra mussels don't exist in Oregon. However, we have learned that on 3 occasions in April and May of last year, Nevada Division of Wildlife stocked fish from an infested Lake Mead fish hatchery into Wild Horse Reservoir on the Owyhee River in northwest Nevada. The Owyhee flows to the Snake River, which flows to the Columbia. It is unknown if Wild Horse was inoculated, but a team of scientists and managers is poised to survey the reservoir as soon as ice melts and the reservoir is accessible. This incident represents a very real threat to Oregon's waterways and another potentially painful blow to our efforts to recover salmon stocks in the Columbia Basin. It also demonstrates how easy invasive species are spread. Even if quaggas don't migrate downstream or aren't in Wild Horse Reservoir, they can easily be spread by boats, by anglers, and by other folks. Of course, our focus with this bill is on boats. It's important to note that Wild Horse Reservoir is just 4 hours from the border, and that in talking to Marine deputies at a recent conference, they regularly see Nevada license plates at some of our most popular fisheries, including Wallowa Lake and some other water bodies. House Bill 3435 may be considered an annoyance by boaters. They will argue that it's not worth their time to clean their boat, but the price of an infestation is incalculable because it does much more than costs our citizens time and money. In a real sense, each infestation changes Oregon and makes it a bit like everywhere else. Each invasion makes Oregon a little bit less unique. House Bill 3435 is, in our opinion, a reasonable response to help us prevent, or at the very least, postpone damaging and costly invasions by non-native species. There were a couple of specific points in the bill that I wanted to address. One minor alteration is in regards to an exemption. We would like to clarify the hunting and photo blind exemption in Section 2.3 to either explicitly or through rule adopt the Department of Agriculture's list of noxious weeds as being prohibited for use as blind material. We believe that would alleviate any concerns by hunters that we would be impacting their ability to hunt from a boat using duck blind, to have blind material on their boat, or for photographers and that sort of thing. It would essentially allow any vegetation, especially natural vegetation or vegetation that's processed like you would buy through Cabela's, but it would prevent the use of Spartina or other weeds that are noxious and listed by the Department of Agriculture. A number of questions I get on the bill, the most common questions I get related to the language in the bill is in Section 2-2-A. The term any visible aquatic species sounds particularly broad, but alternatives are difficult to find. Other states have listed a specific plants of animal or animals. They'll have rules that list all of the animals that can't be on, all the species that can't be on your boat, which requires any spotter to be a virtual biologist. You have to be able to tell hydrilla from milfoil, and it's a very difficult thing to do. By stating any visible aquatic species, it makes it very simple for, say, a watershed council, a local homeowners group, or a fisherman or other individual to see a boat that's being washed with weeds on it, to ask the person, to educate the person about the need to clean the boat, and then to engage law enforcement if they need to. One final point I want to make is why we treat what's in the boat differently than what's on the hull or the trailer. Section 2-2-B prohibits aquatic species detrimental to wildlife of the state, as opposed to all aquatic species that are on the hull, as noted in 2-2-A. The reason for the differentiation is quite simple. We don't want to make it illegal to possess live crabs, crawdads, legally harvested seaweeds, crustaceans, fish, wildlife, etc., which are typically stowed in coolers or live wells within the craft. It's what's on the hull, or it's illegal species within the hull, that are the focus of this language. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have at this time.
Hard to believe. Yeah, the other question.
So if the, it's probably a good question, if the person doing the judging of the aquatic species as detrimental to the state knows what's detrimental, or not to the state, excuse me, to the wildlife in this state, inside the hole, why wouldn't they know what's detrimental outside?
When we worked on this language, there were sort of two levels that we tried to get at. One is recognizing when we looked at what other states were doing, and a number of other states have similar legislation, or they prohibit transportation of listed species or things like that. It becomes pretty clear that the bulk of enforcement isn't done by law enforcement who's standing at a boat ramp. It's done by the citizens groups or other interested folks through educational processes, through watershed councils doing free boat inspections on any given day. Mm-hmm. A quick visual inspection, we felt, was the most adequate, was the most accessible way for somebody to make a determination that the boat needed to be clean. Boats going in and out of the water, they've got weeds on them, that's an obvious concern. We went to a higher level within the boat, first of all, to allow people to have their crabs or their crawdads or whatever might be going in and out. But if there was an indication that there's illegal zebra mussels or other things within the boat, that it would, there would still be force of law behind that. This isn't a real easy question, except that to require a high level of biological knowledge to keep the boat from going in the water is going to make it virtually unenforceable. Yeah. But to not require a better level of identification for what's in the boat, then you're going to make a lot of, you're going to make life difficult for a lot of individuals.
And as long as I keep it inside the boat, it's not a problem.
Right.
Yes.
Nick, well, go ahead. I just, it is, in terms of detrimental to the wildlife in this state, I mean, a crab with a mean left hook is detrimental. Is there not some sort of recognized list of invasive species not native to Oregon, some other language?
Yes, this is fairly generalized language that came out of legislative council. The original language was to refer to lists developed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And that's what we would prefer to have in there, but this is what came out.
Can we add
some amendments?
Can
we add California? Because we have to do the other amendment anyway.
Can we add California? Because I don't think you can answer any of my questions. I mean, Fish and Wildlife, Ag, and State Police. I mean, somebody's got to enforce this. Someone's got to recognize it. I want to hear from State Police how they're going to do this.
Okay.
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
No problem.
Before they start impounding.
Yeah.
Okay.
In our district. We're all
any other questions?
We'll catch the Dickens on this one.
No questions. I'll talk to you later. We'll talk about the one amendment you talked about, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
All right.
We'll close that hearing on 3435. And thanks for hanging around, everyone. We'll close our Ag and Natural Resources.